One of the most remarkable aspects of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. He was born in 1801, she in 1804. He was a man known for his humor and gruffness, she a woman known for her sobriety and refinement. He preached unforgettable sermons, though he never learned to spell. She wrote reams of poetry and songs. This is how our guest today describes Brigham Young and Eliza R. Snow. Jill Mulvey-Durr is here in studio to talk about The Lion and the Lioness. Welcome back to Legacy, Jill.
Thank you.
Faithful Legacy listeners will remember that Jill has been on the show before discussing Eliza R. Snow's minutes for the Nauvoo Relief Society. Please tell us your reasoning for titling your publication, The Lion and the Lioness.
Brigham Young has long been known as the Lion of the Lord. I think that name fits him. He was strong and certainly was the chief of the Mormon people. He could clearly roar like a lion and protected his family. And when I say that, I mean his extended family, the community of saints, the kingdom of God. Eliza likewise was a fierce defender of the kingdom, and she could also growl and roar. And I think the way that they worked together had a kind of ferocity and energy to it, as well as remarkable dignity.
So will it come to a surprise to the casual historian that Eliza R. Snow was married to Brigham Young?
I think that a lot of people probably are surprised to find that Eliza Snow was married to Brigham Young. We have the issue of the name to start with. She married him in 1844 as one of his plural wives, the eighth of his plural wives. But she did not ever take on the name of Young. Nevertheless, he cared for her, provided a home for her. They had a very close relationship. And in the end, upon her death in 1887, she was buried in Brigham Young's private cemetery here in Salt Lake City.
So we have two extraordinary and fiercely strong individuals, you call them. How did they get along?
I think these two had a remarkable relationship. It isn't the kind of relationship we would typically think of as a husband-wife relationship. And, of course, in plural marriage, there were many different kinds of relationships. Some people were married for time and eternity. Some people just for eternity. Some couples had children together. Other husband-wife relationships did not bring forth children. In the case of Brigham Young and Eliza R. Snow, there were no children born to this union. And there is nothing in the evidence we have to suggest that they had a marriage with connubial relations, that they were of one flesh, as the biblical term would put it. Brigham Young's daughters and others who witnessed their relationship didn't see this as that kind of relationship. On the other hand, we see a lot of affection, a lot of mutual respect, a lot of communication, a lot of mutual assistance and support in these two individuals who were able to carry that forward into their work with the church and expand a lot of responsibilities for women and also build the kingdom by incorporating women into the organization, Relief Society Young Women, as well as numerous other enterprises that help the kingdom, the women's engagement in home industry or medical work, for example.
So you mentioned this relationship of respect and affection. Did that come immediately? You mentioned they were married in 1844, which was right after the prophet's assassination.
That's right. Eliza R. Snow was sealed as a plural wife of Joseph Smith in June of 1842. And she was extremely devoted to Joseph Smith. She called him the choice of my heart and the crown of my life, and spoke with him always with deep affection. A number of poems that she wrote in Nauvoo about Joseph Smith, I think, reflect that kind of feeling. Now, Eliza's relationship with Brigham Young, I think, was quite different from that. They were sealed for time after Joseph's death. And one has the sense, at least I have the sense, that they may not have been well acquainted at that time. Certainly they would have known each other. How well they would have known each other, what their communications were, what their relationship might have been, I don't really know. I don't think we have evidence for that. But we do know both of them were totally committed to Joseph Smith and to his vision of bringing forth the kingdom of God in preparation for the second coming of the Savior. So they shared a common vision, and I think over time that pulled them together. We can see, really the only hint we have of this initial relationship is in a poem that Eliza wrote supporting Brigham Young in early in 1845. She had written a lot of poems in support of Joseph Smith as prophet, and her first attempt at doing something similar for Brigham Young was in February of 1845. And these words don't sing as musically as much of her poetry. This poem begins, "An important station is truly thine, and the weight of thy calling can none define, being called of the Lord or the 12 to preside, and with them over all of the world beside. Thou hast gained, like Elisha, a rich behest, for the mantle of Joseph seems to rest upon thee, while the spirit and power divine that inspired his heart is inspiring thine. The great work which he laid the foundation to is unfinished and resting on thee to do." It's okay, and it certainly fills the need of the time, and there was a need at that time for someone as well-known as Eliza R. Snow to show her support in a very public way for Brigham Young, and she did that again and again. Both of these people, both Brigham and Eliza, had placed a high value on loyalty. Loyalty was extremely important to both of them. And I think again and again we see Eliza establish her loyalty through her support, initially through these poems. As I said, both of them felt an immense loyalty to Joseph Smith and the vision that he articulated. Brigham reciprocates. He's also very loyal and helpful to Eliza. But initially, I would say they don't know each other so well, and that the awkwardness in that relationship eases over time.
Can you describe for us how Brigham, he had an immense family at the time that they left Nauvoo, and it could not have been easy to keep track of all these individuals as they're crossing the plains in various different companies.
That's right. They did cross the plains in different companies. And I don't know that I would be able to say a lot about what happened with each of those families, but we do get a sense from Eliza R. Snow of how he interacted with her. It's interesting. She noted so many times in her diary when she encountered him or when he came to see her, if he stopped by the tent, if he took her for a carriage ride, if they had a conversation. All of these things are noted in her diary. And sometimes he's noted as President Y, and sometimes he's noted as B. So I think you can see greater familiarity developing between these two as they cross the plains. She also writes a lot in her diary about his family, the female family. And I think this is probably one of the ways that she grew closest to him. In other words, you, as you've expressed, the wives and children of Brigham Young did not all cross in the same company. They were not all together in the same wagons. But once they got to winter quarters, you have the sense that this family is really pulling together as a family. And that is one of the benefits of plural marriage. It was one of the functions that it really performed, was to organize people in what we might call a tribal sense, even though that word is not one we would use. But in these great families where they could know and support one another and know that they would have support. And at Winter Quarters particularly, we see Eliza R. Snow spending lots of time with Marianne Angell Young, Brigham Young's first wife. His first wife was actually Miriam Works, who died, and in Kirtland he married Marianne Angell, so we think of her as his first wife. But Eliza's spending a lot of time with her, who is about her age, and with younger wives of Brigham Young. These women come together for a lot of conversation. They come together to pray together, to sing together, to exercise spiritual gifts and bless one another. And this is a very joyous time for Eliza as she meets with the women in this family, whom, as I said, she calls the female family. And I think this is an important part of her drawing closer to Brigham Young, this sense of the whole young family pulling together and drawing together and learning to support and love one another.
You mentioned that Brigham and Eliza could be compared to a 19th century couple, like a minister and his wife, who travel around together doing their job, so to speak. Could you talk a little bit about that type of relationship?
I think that part of their relationship occurs much later than the period we're talking about, by about 20 years.
Okay.
Initially, Eliza is part of this household in winter quarters. She actually crosses the plains before Brigham Young, before the rest of his family. Brigham Young goes with the Vanguard group, the Pioneer Company, in April of 47 and arrives in July. She leaves sometime later in the summer and arrives in the fall in the Salt Lake Valley. But most of Brigham Young's family is still back in winter quarters. She's living with Clara Decker, the wife who crossed the plains with Brigham Young. And that period from winter quarters to the Salt Lake Valley, early time with the Young family in the log row and then later in the Lion House, is a period when you really would not recognize her as a minister's wife in many ways. Brigham Young is carrying forth the business of the kingdom. The priesthood organization is well established. She is helping work to make the household self-sustaining. The weaving that went on in that household, the sewing, she was a wonderful seamstress, and I'm sure those skills were called upon in that household. The caring for the sick and for the children, which especially caring for the sick, she was part of at this early time. So we don't really see her in the late 1840s or 1850s functioning in that particular role. Now, in 1855, she does get a special assignment from him that other women in his household did not have, and that is she was called to preside over women's ordinance work in the endowment house. The endowment house was known as the House of the Lord. That was the forerunner of the temple. And it was built in 1855 to provide a place for ordinances to be performed until the temple could be completed, or a temple could be completed. St. George was completed in 1877. So she was there 4 or 5 days a week officiating in those ordinances, and that was a call that came to her from Brigham Young. Brigham Young's daughter, Sousa Young Gates, who wrote about Eliza, said that when that call was extended to Eliza, it was extended with a promise that if she would accept that calling, her health would improve. In crossing the plains, she became very ill, we think probably with tuberculosis. And so she spent a lot of time coughing. One of her sister wives, Margaret Pierce Young, talks about Eliza in the log row coughing her lungs out. I'm sure that this impeded other things that Eliza might have done during this period. But Brigham Young extended to her this promise, and with her work in the endowment house and other treatments that Eliza took, she was able to actually be in better health in the 1860s than she was during this earlier period. And this work in the endowment house, I don't know that it really would have had a counterpart in other American religions. It gave her a chance to exercise authority in blessing women, both within the formal ritual and outside that ritual. And it gave her a great sense of the order of the priesthood and the principles of the priesthood. It was a very important part of her development, and perhaps Brigham Young could see that in giving her that assignment. So by 1868, when she is called to help with the Relief Society, she's been doing that work for nearly 13 years. But as you mentioned, she does become a partner with Brigham Young in organizational work. Often a minister's wife in Protestant America would have traveled with her husband. She would have also helped with the poor and the needy. She might well have been the head of the benevolent society that was connected to the congregation. And it was in this sense, I think, with her calling in 1868, that we see Eliza take on something of that role. She also becomes head of the Relief Society in a certain sense. So in many respects, she would look like a minister's wife, except that this particular minister had many wives, and she only had to play a portion of that role. In other words, Brigham Young has family members who are supporting him in different ways. So other people administering to his emotional needs and physical needs in a way that many ministers' wives would have done. But he has a much more complex family, and he has a much more complex responsibility, because a typical minister would have dealt with a single congregation.
Right.
And Brigham Young is dealing with these congregations scattered through the territory, as well as administering the other work of the church. So this call comes several months after Brigham Young makes an initial call for Relief Societies to be reorganized. And that probably is a surprise to some of our listeners.
Perhaps you can recount what happened in Nauvoo and how it sort of tapered off for a while. If you would, please.
I will. In Nauvoo, Eliza was actually the secretary of the Relief Society. She kept the minutes of its meetings. Emma Smith was president. And those meetings began in 1842 under Joseph Smith's direction. He addressed many of their meetings, and they continued until March of 1844, when we really don't know exactly why, but the meeting of March 16th in the afternoon was the last meeting of the Relief Society. There was a lot of conflict at that time regarding plural marriage, and of course Emma Smith wasn't a stranger to that conflict. She had vacillated in her embrace of plural marriage and her total rejection of that principle. It's not clear from the minutes of that meeting exactly where she was in that vacillation, but I think one might assume that she was at that moment in time opposed to plural marriage and perhaps actively seeking to engage sisters in opposing it. So we know that meetings stopped in March of 44, and a year later, in March of 45, following the martyrdom and Brigham Young's leadership as president of the Quorum of the Twelve, his assuming leadership of those in the church who would support him, and that was not everyone, but his assuming leadership of the church and the programs that Joseph had introduced, including the completion of the temple. In March of 45, for some reason, Brigham Young reacted against any possibility of Relief Society. He, I think, could show that the dissension over plural marriage and the extent to which women had participated in that had fueled the opposition in the church, fueled the divisiveness, and as I mentioned earlier, he was he so valued loyalty, and I think he saw Emma's actions as disloyal, her opposition to plural marriage, her reluctance to support the 12, and I think he saw the possibility that she might rally other women in working counter to what the 12 were trying to do. So in March of 45, he made a pretty unequivocal statement that there was not to be any meeting of the Relief Society or of women, and that when he wanted the Relief Society to be reestablished, he would reestablish it. It's a harsh statement. It's very unequivocal. And I think you see women continuing to gather in very small ways as they cross the plains. We've talked about his own family, the women in his own family coming together for prayer, for blessing meetings, and other small groups of women did this. Of course, women continued to administer to the sick and the needy, but they did not have a Relief Society organization. In 1854, we have a small group of women in Utah who come together independently to form what they call an Indian Relief Society. Brigham Young had been calling upon the women to help provide clothing to the Indians. Even then, Brigham Young quickly moves in and says, we will have Indian Relief Societies. They will be organized in each ward under the direction of bishops, not independently of the priesthood organization. And those Relief Societies thrived, we have to say, 1854 to 1858. They are organized in Salt Lake City, as far south as Spanish Fork and Cedar City. So Relief Societies are revived, but there's a challenge here in that not a lot of women are familiar with Relief Society. Certainly many bishops wouldn't have been familiar, and there's no central leadership for the Relief Society. So these Relief Societies did much good. They were active in assisting with the handcart pioneers, for example. They assisted in at the time of the coming of the federal troops to Utah under Johnston's army in 1857-58, and they helped the saints with the move south in 1858 when saints north of Provo evacuated and moved further south in the event that the army troops came through the city, which they eventually did. So I think, and then the saints moved back, but the disruption that came with that move south, and for other reasons we don't know, these relief societies that existed largely faded away. We have some who continue some activity, especially in Cedar City, Spanish Fork, who weren't impacted by the move. We see some continuation. But where they exist, they are irregular. The movement is somewhat sporadic. So in 1867, actually at the end of 1866, there's some talk about the reorganization of the Relief Society, and it's almost a year later, in December of 1867, Brigham Young calls upon bishops to organize Relief Societies in their individual wards. Now, that was anticipating the immigration that was to be significant in 1868, partly because the saints knew the railroad was coming and they wanted as many of the saints to be here before the non-members, the Gentiles, started arriving by railroad. So there's that push for immigration, and there's also an immense push to build the temple. And that push to build the temple thrust more responsibility for caring for the poor to bishops in their individual wards. And Brigham Young could see that those individual wards would need the assistance of relief societies. So he called in December of 1867 for bishops to organize relief societies. And we can tell from the central meeting of bishops in Salt Lake, as they reported, that the response was not significant. These are men who didn't know a lot about Relief Society, and there's just not much of a response. I've said in previous works that I've published that Eliza was probably called in 1867 when this initial push was made. From my perspective now, I feel like she was probably called in April of 1868, when the second push was made. Brigham Young announced again in April conference of 1868 that he wanted these relief societies organized, and assuring the bishops that the sisters would love to move forward in this work. I am sure that he knew that from talking to Eliza and other women in his family. But in April of 68, he apparently called Eliza to go work with individual bishops, ward by ward, help them set up the organization as it had been set up in Nauvoo, with a president and two counselors, with a secretary and a treasurer. And that's what she did. She took those minutes of the original meetings in Nauvoo. She went from ward to ward and helped them set up organizations, explained purposes to the bishops. So she standardized relief society. And in some wards where it had been organized, we can see that they reorganize under this new directive, with a better understanding of what relief society is. She says she loved her work with the bishops. And Brigham Young, for his part, was extremely supportive. So on the one hand, while you have this very harsh, discouraging statement in 1845, in 1867-68, you have Brigham Young saying, we want the sisters. This is the time. They need to come forward. There is so much they can do. And these dear sisters, whose energies hadn't been called upon for many years, just rushed forward in the work. I mean, you can actually feel the surge of energy as these women come forward, not only to aid the poor, but they just find so much work to do. Now, Eliza played an important role in this, in her relationship with Brigham Young, because he trusted her. They had been together for a long time. She had been working in the House of the Lord, the Endowment House. She knew the importance of priesthood order and ordinances. So when she begins to organize these relief societies, she's very clear that I love the phrase she uses, the relief society is self-governing under the direction of the priesthood. And I think that gives both of the strains that are important part of this movement, that women need to be active. They need to work they need to exercise their own talents, their own initiative. They need to have energy in carrying forward the work. At the same time, they're going to take counsel from their bishops, from their other priesthood leaders, and work in harmony with those leaders. And she is so adamant about this, that in the kingdom of God, the interests of men and women cannot be divided. Our interests are the same, and we're going to work together. So that's the note she sounds when these relief societies are reorganized. She is very clear in most occasions about issuing a warning about speaking against plural marriage, because obviously in Nauvoo that had been a problem. So she doesn't want the sisters to speak against polygamy. But on the other hand, boy, they are going to move forward. And Brigham Young gives them many signals that they should.
We'll just remind our listeners, we're visiting with Jill Mulvey-Durr today and discussing Brigham Young and Eliza R. Snow and their amazing relationship. Let me just ask this question. These two larger-than-life individuals, they were undoubtedly loved by members of the church, both prominent, both very influential, and they were married to each other. But was there ever what we'd consider in our day and age like a conflict of interest? I mean, he's asking her to write poetry for the church. I don't know if that even would be considered an issue in their day, as opposed to perhaps ours.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I don't think, in terms of his asking her to write poetry for the church, there was any conflict of interest there. In Missouri, she had a conversation with Joseph Smith, one that we can't exactly pinpoint, but we can certainly see the results from. And that conversation had to do with the role of her poetry vis-a-vis the church. I think it was pretty clear at that moment in time that she was going to write poetry for and on behalf of the church. So one of the things that Brigham Young did once in his capacity as president of the Quorum of the Twelve and that interim head of the church until the first presidency was reestablished in 1847, I think on numerous occasions he asked her to write poems. That was especially true crossing the plains. We see her writing many songs for the trail, and in Utah too, songs for the anticipated State of Deseret in celebration of the 4th and 24th of July. I don't think there was a conflict of interest there. She made space in her writing to write a few of the kinds of things that she wanted to write. But I think that writing to extend Brigham Young's influence or to extend the position of the church was not a problem for her. She was not a poet in the sense of Emily Dickinson or those who followed in Emily Dickinson's tradition, who wrote confessional private poetry. Eliza, for the most part, was a public poet. Her poems were meant to be read on public occasions or posted on broadsides. So I don't see a conflict of interest here, actually probably a great unity of interest. And Brigham Young liked her poems, praised her poems, recommended her book of poetry, sent her volume of poems to people. There wasn't a conflict of interest there. There may have been in other dimensions, but not around the poetry.
So she was appointed, shall we say, poetess or poet laureate by Joseph Smith, and perhaps was just continuing this as a calling that she considered, and so it never really changed.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think as we might say, poetry filled the role of public relations, in a sense, the same way that in today's media we might feature things on the internet to talk about what our beliefs are or to respond to news stories that are against the church. The church also used the press, but her poetry played very much that same role.
Now, her official calling as Relief Society president, did that come before or after this big push where she went around to the bishops and started actually organizing the Relief Society?
You know, that's a very interesting question. I think that you would have to say that in many respects, as she began this work with bishops, and shortly thereafter, Brigham Young called her to teach the women or instruct the women, which in her mind was a separate call. I think you would have to say that she functioned as Relief Society General President, and yet she was not set apart for that calling. She was called the president of the Relief Societies. She filled that role in every respect that we would see a Relief Society president filling that role. But she was not officially appointed president of the Relief Society in 1868. That actually didn't happen until after Brigham Young's death in 1880. Why that is, I am not sure. For one thing, the original instructions of Joseph Smith to the Relief Society made it clear that when Emma and her counselors were appointed to those positions, they were to be, in Joseph's words, like the first presidency of the church. They were to serve essentially for life. Whether Brigham Young was honoring that in that Emma Smith was still alive, I don't know. The minutes don't actually say these women are to serve for life. They say they are to serve during good behavior. But I can see that no one would want to cast aspersions on Emma. And maybe the women themselves didn't feel comfortable doing that. Maybe they felt that she still held that presidency title in an honorific way. It is about a year after Emma's death, slightly more than a year, that Eliza is set apart by John Taylor as general president of the Relief Society. I would have to say, in most ways, she functioned as the president of the Relief Society, that there were some questions posed about that beginning in 1877 when Brigham Young himself organized stake Relief Society presidencies and called and set apart women to function as stake Relief Society presidents. So there is a sort of murky period there, I would say, especially from 1877 on, when it's not exactly clear what role Eliza is playing, and especially after Brigham Young's death, because I think much of her, much of the influence and authority she had was associated with her close relationship to him.
Can you explain the use of the word presidentess, or did I even pronounce it correctly?
Yes. Since we don't use it, I'm not sure
exactly
how it is pronounced, if it's presidentess or presidentess. This is a term that was used in Nauvoo with respect to Emma Smith. She was the presidentess of the Relief Society, sometimes called presidentess, sometimes president or Mrs. President. This was a popular, very popular thing in the 19th century. So if you had a benevolent society that had a leader, not all of them were called president. They were often called directors. So we see directoress in some of those cases. We have in 1868 when these Relief Societies were reestablished, particularly Sarah Kimball, who was in the 15th Ward, the president of the 15th Ward Relief Society, a very close associate of Eliza's, a woman very interested in women's advancement. She and Eliza take very seriously Joseph Smith's instructions, as recorded in the original Relief Society minutes, that the sisters could appoint officers. Joseph Smith said, as the teachers and deacons are appointed among us. And they did that. They had, in the 15th Ward, they had what they called deaconesses. It isn't that they were ordained to the office of deacon, but they performed some of those temporal responsibilities. They set up the hall for meetings. the visiting teachers were also known as a teacher's quorum. But there were never teacheresses; they were just teachers. but there were there was that ESS ending added to other parts of this organization. In the 15th Ward, there was a commission merchantess, and she was the one who took the goods that the sisters collected for the poor and evaluated their value and helped determine to whom they would be distributed.
So it sounds like when the official call came, whether early or late, or whether she was a president or a presidentess, it seems Eliza Arsenault was uniquely qualified to take over this women's organization because of her past experience with the Nauvoo as the secretary, her work in the Endowment House, and her relationship with President Brigham Young. It seemed to have all fallen into place.
It certainly did. And I think as you say, her own capacities, her great spiritual gifts, certainly were an important part of this calling. I see that Endowment House experience as very important to her. When she goes forward to speak, and as I say, for her, that was a separate calling from Brigham Young, this calling to instruct the sisters. When she goes forth to speak, she does so with power. She does so with the power of the Spirit. And women are deeply touched when she is addressing their meetings. This isn't simply an administrative assignment. This has to do with inspiring women, and she could certainly do that. And as I said, she carries with her the authority from Brigham Young. And so many of the things that women pushed forward, so much of the work they pushed forward really came at his bidding. And when I say at his bidding, I fully believe that he and Eliza and probably other women and other brethren discussed what would be appropriate for these women to do. So you see so many things going forward with his endorsement. I'm just trying to think of a couple that I could give you examples of. For one, and a very important one, the Young Women's Organization, Brigham Young's concern about that the railroad coming in 1869, the easier importation of goods from outside, and what that would mean to the saints' economy. He was trying to preserve the saints' independence, not only spiritually, but economically. And so 1869, the early 1870s, this is the period of cooperatives. And so he introduces several initiatives that help keep money among the saints instead of sending it east. He wants that wealth to be kept among the saints. So he wants them to support their homemade home industries and their homemade goods. So we see this with his encouragement of the silk industry. And one of his other wives, Dinah Diantha Huntington Young, becomes the director, in a sense, of the silk movement. And so we see women planting the mulberry trees, gathering the leaves that are going to feed the silkworms they're raising so they can weave their own silk. Of course, there's a whole mission, the cotton mission, to raise cotton and develop cotton. Women are part of storing grain. That's something that Brigham Young calls them to. They are part of encouraging medical training for women. And actually financing sisters going east to medical school, like Romania Pratt, who had Brigham Young's support. So as Eliza goes around and talks about these different things, she can say, President Young has asked this, President Young has asked that, President Young has our support here, or really drawing from Joseph Smith's words to the Relief Society about turning the key to women. We see Eliza saying Brigham Young has turned the key to women that we might go forward in these activities. So, yes, his endorsement is a critical part of this. And, of course, in the case of the young women, he expects his own daughters to lead out in forming a retrenchment association, these groups that later became known as the Young Ladies Mutual Improvement and then Young Women's Mutual Improvement, and finally just Young Women, as we know those organizations today. It was important to him that this started in his household, that his family was setting an example. And Eliza was there when his family was organized, and she was able to do the same thing she'd done with the Relief Society, and that is move from ward to ward, organize young women, and saying, this is what President Young wants us to do. So we expect you to step forward and determine that you're going to make your own clothing, that you're going to read good literature, all of these things that were part of the initial retrenchment movement.
This has been a fun conversation. What else would you say about the lion and the lioness here as a final word, perhaps, Jill?
I think one thing I would say is that we tend to see these as public figures, as larger-than-life figures, as you've mentioned. We see Brigham Young roaring from the tabernacle pulpit or Eliza going forth to do this organizational work. But they were also private people who operated within a family and within a household. And it was a household where there was lots of mutual support, affection, and humor. And Brigham Young was a kind, indulgent father, as Eliza described him. And within their own relationship and within that household, I think we see a sense of intimacy and care. I think of Eliza going to New York on her way to a greater trip to Europe and the Middle East, and stopping by West Point, where Brigham Young has a son, and her writing a letter to Brigham to talk about embracing that son and how he accompanied them to the very gates of the campus. And I think in those pictures you get a sense of the deep love and affection in that family. So, yes, they roared like lions and were fierce, but they were also tender, loving, supportive people within this family unit.
Thank you. I'll remind our listeners of the last discussion we had with Jill about the Nauvoo Relief Society notes that Eliza R. Snow kept, and we discussed that, and it's available on the podcast. So thank you very much for being with us today, Jill.
Thank you.